Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. Here's news just in from Capitol Hill. Since the scandal broke over the sale of aborted baby parts, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley has been investigating Planned Parenthood. The result is a bombshell that might be lost in the rush of Christmas news as well as during the ongoing transition. Here's the pertinent news. Planned Parenthood is being referred for criminal investigation to the Justice Department and the FBI by the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which Grassley is the chair. Now, bear in mind that the Justice Department that does the investigating will not be Obama's notoriously incompetent gang of political hacks. This is a vital investigation that should finally show results. Dateline Washington. Following an investigation into the practice of fetal tissue transfers and the federal laws governing the practice, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley is referring several Planned Parenthood affiliates and companies involved in fetal tissue transfers, as well as the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, to the FBI and the Department of Justice for investigation and possible prosecution. Grassley quotes, "I don't take lightly making a criminal referral, but the seeming disregard for the law by these entities has been fueled by decades of utter failure by the Justice Department to enforce it," Grassley said. "And unless there is a renewed commitment by everyone involved against commercializing the trade in aborted fetal body parts for profit, then the problem is likely to continue," end quote. Now, Grassley's referral follows the completion of a Senate Judiciary Committee majority staff analysis of more than 20,000 pages of documents provided voluntarily by the organizations and companies involved. While the impetus for the investigation was the release of a series of videos regarding transfers of fetal tissue by the Center for Medical Progress, the committee's analysis and findings are based strictly on the documents obtained independently from tissue procurement companies and Planned Parenthood. Here are some of the conclusions. Despite the clear legislative history of the 1993 NIH Revitalization Act, the executive branch across multiple administrations has failed to enforce the law's safeguards. Since 2010, three companies, Advanced Bioscience Resources Incorporated, STEM Express LLC, and Novogenics Laboratories LLC. Novogenics, interestingly, has since gone out of business. They have paid affiliates of Planned Parenthood Federation of America to acquire aborted fetuses and then sold the fetal tissue to their respective customers at substantially higher prices than their documented costs. The Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, initially had a policy in place to ensure its affiliates were complying with the law, but the affiliates failed to follow its fetal tissue reimbursement policy. When PPFA learned in 2011 of this situation, PPFA canceled the policy rather than exercise oversight to bring the affiliates back into compliance. Thus, PPFA not only turned a blind eye to the affiliates' violation of its fetal tissue policy, but also altered its own oversight procedures, enabling those affiliates' practices to continue unimpeded. The cost analyses provided by affiliates of Planned Parenthood for America lack sufficient documentation and rely on reasonably broad and vague claims of costs for the transportation, implantation, processing, preservation, quality control, or storage of, end quote, fetal tissue. Planned Parenthood attorneys acknowledge that the affiliates had failed to follow procedures put in place to ensure compliance with the law. In addition, the cost analyses were only performed long after the fact and at the insistence of the committee. Now, the full report details the long history of the controversy surrounding human fetal tissue research and the bipartisan legislative approach taken to resolve the issue at the time. as well as the subsequent lack of enforcement. As the report explains, support for the 1993 NIH Revitalization Act was premised on the idea that the ban on buying or selling fetal tissue would be a safeguard against the development for a market for human fetuses. Tragically, the executive branch has either failed or simply refused to enforce that safeguard. As a result, contrary to the intent of the law, companies have charged thousands of dollars for specimens removed from a single aborted fetus. They have claimed the fees they charged only recovered acceptable costs when they had not in fact conducted any analysis of their costs when setting the fees, and their post hoc accounting rationalizations invoked indirect and tenuously related costs in an attempt to justify their fees. We will keep you posted on the developments as these investigations go forward under the new administration. In the meantime, this is PRI Review. We'll be right back. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood abortion liberales Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our Pro-Life Victory Seminars and our Pro-Life Strategy Guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today, the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now, we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. Reports have appeared in the news recently indicating that, all other things being equal, marriage is more common among people of means than among the poor. Of course, that's a snapshot. A simple look behind that statistic can be quite revealing because the family is a lot more than a mere economical unit. Yes, Aristotle says that the family is where economics begins, and that's still true today. High schools used to have courses in what was called home economics, teaching students the basics of running a household because the home was the smallest social economic unit. But for Aristotle, the family was about a lot more than economics. It was about education, the rearing of children, the formation of good habits, and providing the foundation for a society pursuing what we would today call the common good, based on a common view of civic virtue and a fundamental sense of mutual responsibility. Our secularized society today sees things differently. The French revolutionaries worshipped equality. Today's version is called diversity. Those who worship this pagan goddess deny the very notion of the common good because, after all, we have nothing in common to be good about. What's good for you might not be good for me, as the newly minted old saying goes. This is the slogan of the prophets of what Pope Benedict calls the dictatorship of relativism. The notion of virtue is offensive to such profligates because it is so judgmental and anti-progressive. Unfortunately, this attitude has seeped into our nation's prevailing education system. As virtually every truth is challenged, so-called educators have realized that there isn't very much truth left to educate children about. Instead, they have adopted a superficial curriculum that warns students against offending anyone, except for Christians, of course. After all, Christians are backward nostalgia freaks who just don't want anybody to have any fun after sex education class. At the college level, this educational drivel has come to be called the School of the Politically Correct, or PC for short, and that brings us back to the challenge facing the families of the future. Now, these reports addressing the issues of relative wealth and marriage emerged as part of a larger conversation on the difficulty that today's 20-somethings have in finding gainful employment, or indeed, in finding any work at all. A good part of this problem, and it is a problem, can be attributed to the nation's struggling economy. But there is another dimension that gets less coverage in the modern media because it is less harmonious with the new paganism. Let's take a typical middle-class family, a married couple with two children. Economically, they're on solid footing. Now they get divorced. What happens? Now we have two households instead of one, each new household with a net worth reduced by more than half compared to the one they used to share. After the lawyer's fees and the cost of establishing two new homes, consider the emotional and physical wear and tear on the family, the kids, and the ability of everybody involved to fulfill their responsibilities at work, school, and in the home. There are countless catalysts for today's trend to marry late or not to marry at all. College students will tell you that while they might be nervous about marriage, they are really terrorized by the prospect of divorce. Young women especially recognize that through no fault of their own, they could be left by the side of the road with their children after a quick and cheap and easy no-fault divorce lodged by a husband who simply decided he was ready to move on. These newly single mothers, as well as what we used to call unwed mothers in the pre-Woodstock vernacular, are much more likely to be poor than married mothers. The children of these poor mothers are much more likely to perform poorly in school, at work, and in social interaction. According to Justice Department figures, boys who grow up in fatherless homes are much more likely to be in trouble with the law in their teenage years, as well as later on in life. Girls who grow up without a father in the home will lack judgment and paternal guidance when choosing their male companions. And that's a recipe for social and sexual disaster. Moreover, mortgages are affordable only to those with decent salaries and real jobs. Those come with a serious college education, which a degree these days does not guarantee. And whether educated or not, the college grad has a debt that is often greater than a mortgage. This poses a special threat to the college student graduating next May with intentions of getting a job, getting married, and having a family. Now, 60 years ago, the vast majority of American women were married by the time they were 25 years old. That's where the term baby boom was born. And that began after millions of men came home from the wars, married, and had children. Today, an uncomfortable percentage of 25-year-olds are still living at home. That is, the home they grew up in, and they're big-time single. In fact, the single provision of Obamacare that is most popular allows children to stay on their parents' health insurance policies until they are 26 years old. Now, granted, the young are least likely to use such health care benefits, but when the new Congress convenes and repeals Obamacare, whatever new legislation they devise will certainly include that provision. Now, Father George Rutler, a wonderful pastor in New York, reminds us that those sailors who won the Battle of Lepanto so many years ago protecting Europe from the infidel, and those kids who stormed the beaches in Normandy in 1944, were, on average, younger than the college students of today who are fearful of taking on any responsibility. You don't need to be a statistician to realize that not only are today's men and women not getting married by age 25, many are not bothering to get married at all. New responsibilities? No way. Ask your local pastor how many wedding masses he celebrated this year. In most parishes, the number has fallen at a staggering rate. So let's return to our theme. The pollsters tell us that people of financial means are more likely to be married than those in poverty. But they don't tell us why. They don't tell us that many people are in poverty because they grew up in a fatherless home, or preferred live-in arrangements to marriage, or are divorced themselves. There is one suggested corollary that we must avoid. If a couple is rich enough, we might assume that they will still be financially intact should they divorce. But that isn't the whole story. Rich fatherless homes can cause just as much damage to the young as poor ones. Here's an example. You might recall the Sandy Hook shooting 4 years ago this week, when 20-year-old Adam Lanza killed 20 students and 6 teachers after killing his mother at home. None of the news reports tells the truth about Adam Lanza's family. In fact, his Wikipedia entry tells us that he was homeschooled through high school by his mother and father. Wrong. In fact, when Adam was 9, 11 years before the Sandy Hook shooting, Adam's father, a rich and very successful Manhattan financier, dumped his wife and moved in with his girlfriend closer to New York. However, because his wife had multiple sclerosis, he charitably did not divorce her, because his very handsome health insurance policy could thus pay for her expensive health care. Adam Lanza grew up in a fatherless home. That his separated parents were wealthy meant nothing. That he grew up in a fatherless home meant nothing to the secular media, because they realized that even telling the simple truth would invite speculation based on the simple natural law of cause and effect. Dad leaves home, children go bad. Well, on campus, to say that, you'd have to issue a trigger warning first. Well, that's not just a truism, it's true. Remember those Justice Department statistics. A child born to an unwed mother, living with a series of boyfriends, not remarrying, or not marrying at all, that child is 20 or 30 times more likely to fail in school, fail at work, and to wind up in trouble with the law than the child who grows up with his biological married parents in the same home until the age of 17. Aristotle was right. The family is not only society's basic economic unit, the family is the foundation of society itself. But today we are told, in fact, we are forced to acknowledge that family means whatever somebody else wants it to mean. And through the looking glass, Lewis Carroll gives us a vivid picture of the result of this twisted distortion of reality. Our friend Humpty Dumpty is speaking to Alice, who is wandering through a maze of narcissists who love themselves more than anything else. Here's how that account goes. "When I use a word," Humpty Dumpty said, in a rather scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less." "The question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things." "The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be master? That's all. Period." End quote. That's right, folks. He who controls the language controls everything. George Orwell had it right in 1984, and the bloody Soviet dictator Stalin had it right when he wrote an entire book on the importance and power of language shortly before he died. The Dictatorship of Relativism features a broad array of Humpty Dumpties, but Through the Looking Glass is a cautionary tale. We recall what happened to Humpty Dumpty when he took a great fall. That can happen to societies too. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. By now, we all know that Planned Parenthood is accused in the United States of allegedly violating the law by, among other atrocities, selling baby body parts. But what you might not realize is that Planned Parenthood's affiliates, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, and International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF, are still getting away with murder overseas. Around the world, and especially in Latin America, the baby-killing giant shades the truth about its abortion-related activities. It runs roughshod over local anti-abortion laws and violates local pro-life sentiment, all with seeming impunity. But not anymore. With your tax-deductible gift, PRI will throw the book at the abortion giants overseas, just as pro-life groups are doing here at home. Did you know that PPFA spends about $38 million a year lobbying to legalize abortion in countries around the world? If they're successful, they can kill as many, if not more, babies overseas as they do in the United States. But there's a hitch. Because abortion remains illegal in most Latin American countries, neither IPPF nor PPFA is eligible for government funding for abortion-related activities as they are in the United States. So PPFA, IPPF, gets around it as only they know how to do, by lying. With a wink and a nod, they disguise the programs they are funding as, quote, education or health programs, women's right, human rights protection or promotion, and anti-discrimination initiatives aimed at protecting vulnerable groups such as women or LGBTs, that means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, end quote. Catholic bishops throughout Africa and Latin America complain about this. They call it ideological imperialism, but their voices are not heard in Congress because America's bishops depend on billions in government funding for their own charities. They don't want to bite the political hand that feeds them. Now, PRI receives no government funding, so we aren't hampered by a golden handcuff. That's why your tax-deductible gift to PRI is so important today. As the lead group investigating Planned Parenthood's activities overseas, PRI's Latin American office has uncovered PPFA's thinly disguised efforts to undermine pro-life laws and legitimate abortion on demand. But we've only found the tip of the iceberg, and there is more work to be done, work that we can't do alone. Your tax-deductible gift will help PRI hire a seasoned pro-life legal team to help us expose, investigate, and prosecute Planned Parenthood's affiliates everywhere they prey on women, especially overseas. Together, we'll expose, investigate, and prosecute PPFA and IPPF everywhere it tries to hide the truth. This two-prong attack, complementing the hearings taking place in Washington, will force Planned Parenthood to fight on two fronts. What better way to strike a blow against the real Planned Parenthood, the one we saw in all those horrific videos, than to come at them here and abroad? So please make a tax-deductible gift to support this and all of PRI's baby-saving efforts around the world. Yes, they're powerful. Yes, they're big. But remember, David and Goliath. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, has announced that it has approved a boxed warning for Bayer, the German company, controversial Assure sterilization device. A boxed warning is the strongest warning the FDA can require for drugs and devices and is intended to alert the user to potentially serious, even deadly side effects that can result from using them. The Assure boxed warning, and that's spelled E-S-S-U-R-E. It's a brand name. That warning will alert patients and health professionals to adverse events associated with the device. They include the possibility for uterine perforation, chronic pain, serious allergic reactions, device migration into the abdominal or pelvic cavity, and the need for the device to be removed surgically if symptoms became unbearable. More than 10,000 women who have suffered adverse medical events associated with Assure have already filed complaints with the FDA, and the number continues to rise daily. Nearly 5,000 women have filed complaints with the FDA this year alone. Bayer itself has received close to 30,000 additional complaints from users of its device. Now, the combination of the public outcry and the unusually high number of complaints has led the FDA to conduct a hearing on safety issues surrounding the device. They held it last September. Now, last February, the FDA announced that it has ordered Bayer to add a boxed warning to the Essure product label to better inform women of the risks involved with using the device. In order to better assess the device's safety, the FDA also mandated Bayer to conduct a post-marketing study, an observational-based study that drug companies are sometimes required to conduct after the device has been released to the public. Bayer is being given 7 years to complete the study, the results of which are not expected to be available until 2023. In the meantime, Bayer will still be able to continue selling its Essure system in the United States. On October 31st, the FDA released the final draft of its recommendations for changes to the Essure label. The boxed warning was released to the public on November 15th. Additionally, a patient checklist was added to make sure that doctors adequately communicate to a potential user the possible risks of using Essure. While a number of changes have been made to the Essure product label, the revisions have come about after tens of thousands of women have already been harmed by the device. For some, the label changes have been too late. Essure has been on the U.S. market for over 14 years. Essure is a device inserted into the fallopian tubes without surgery that eventually sterilizes the patient. The device consists of stainless steel rods coated in plastic and encased within a nickel-titanium alloy coil. The plastic fibers, polyethylene terephthalate, PET, cause the surrounding tissue to become inflamed and grow into the coil after about 3 months. The metal coils remain in the fallopian tubes for life, unless surgically removed. The plastic material in the Essure device is the same material used to manufacture disposable water bottles and automobile tire yarn. For some women, the metal coils have migrated or perforated the fallopian tubes, intestines, or other organs. For still other women, the pain caused by the coils or a severe allergic reaction to nickel may have required them to undergo surgery or even, in a few cases, hysterectomy to remove the device. Although Essure is supposed to make women using the device sterile, pregnancy is still possible, especially before the end of the first 3 months when the device causes complete tubal occlusion. This fact was made obvious when Essure's celebrity spokeswoman, Olympic skier and gold medalist Picabo Street, became pregnant while using it. Bayer was forced to remove all references to Street from their promotional materials. When pregnancies do occur with Essure, they are more likely to be ectopic. Pregnancy loss due to a ruptured membrane, possibly as a result of puncturing, has also been reported. As of February this year, almost half of all pregnancies with Essure, 294 out of 631, resulted in pregnancy loss. While the FDA's belated move is a step in the right direction, many want to see the device banned from the U.S. market altogether. It certainly seems that that's the way to go. The latest recommendations from the FDA do not go far enough, says Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. A boxed warning and patient checklist highlight the severe risks, to be sure, but they're not legally enforceable requirements, he says. Last year, Representative Fitzpatrick introduced a bipartisan bill in Congress called the E, that's a letter E, Free Act, which would circumvent the FDA and ban the Essure device outright. Tens of thousands of women have been harmed by this unsafe medical device, including hundreds of fetal deaths, Representative Fitzpatrick said in his statement. A number of lawsuits have also been filed against Bayer in the United States and Canada. One lawsuit alleges that Bayer unlawfully incentivized the device in order to gain a larger share of patients in the contraceptive commodities market. The lawyers arguing the case allege that Bayer provided free hysteroscopic equipment in exchange for an agreement from doctors that they would purchase, at a minimum, 2 Essure kits per month, regardless of whether or not their patients use them. That borders on kickbacks, which are felonies under federal law, but moving right along, our president at PRI, Stephen Moser, has it right. The FDA seems to go out of its way to protect dangerous contraceptive drugs and devices. Essure is the worst example of the lot. Norplant was taken off the market after the FDA had received only 6,000 complaints. Essure has received over 10,000 already. It's time for the FDA to act to protect women from this dangerous device. That's our weekly briefing. This is PRI Review from pop.org. Thanks for listening.